"Think it over," went on the interpreter. "You're the only Christian priest left in this country. Now you're captured and there's no one left to teach the peasants and spread your doctrine. Aren't you useless?" But now the interpreter's eyes narrowed and his voice quite suddenly assumed a kind and gentle tone. "You heard what Chuan said. He's translating books of astronomy and medicine. He's helping the sick. He's working for other people. Think of this too. As the old Bonds keeps reminding Chuan, the path of mercy means simply that you abandon self. Nobody should worry about getting others into his religious sect. To help others is the way of the Buddha and the teaching of Christianity. In this point, the two religions are the same. What matters is whether or not you walk the path of truth. Sawano is writing this in his Gengiroku." When he had finished speaking, the interpreter looked toward Ferreira for support. The full light of the evening sun flowed down upon the thin back of the aging Ferreira, clad in Japanese garments. Staring at that thin back, the priest sought in vain for the Ferreira who had won his respect at the seminary in Lisbon long ago. Yet now, strange to say, no sentiments of contempt filled his mind. He simply felt his breast swell with the pity one feels for a living being that has lost its life and its spirit. "For 20 years," lowering his eyes, Ferreira whispered weakly, "for 20 years I have laboured in this country. I know it better than you." "During those 20 years as superior, you did marvellous work," said the priest, raising his voice in an attempt to encourage the other. "I read with great respect the letters you sent to the headquarters of the society. Well, before your eyes stands the figure of an old missionary defeated by missionary work." "No one can be defeated by missionary work. When you and I are dead, yet another missionary will board a junk at Macau and secretly come ashore somewhere in this country." "He will certainly be captured." This time it was the interpreter who quickly interrupted. "And whenever one is captured, it is Japanese blood that will flow. How many times have I told you that it is the Japanese who have to die for your selfish dream? It is time to leave us in peace."
"For 20 years I laboured in the mission." With emotionless voice, Ferreira repeated the same words. "The one thing I know is that our religion does not take root in this country."
"It is not that it does not take root," cried Rodriguez in a loud voice, shaking his head. "It's that the roots are torn up." At the loud cry of the priest, Ferreira did not so much as raise his head. Eyes lowered, he answered like a puppet, without emotion.
"This country is a swamp. In time you will come to see that for yourself. This country is a more terrible swamp than you can imagine. Whenever you plant a sapling in this swamp, the roots begin to rot, the leaves grow yellow and wither, and we have planted the sapling of Christianity in this swamp. There was a time when the sapling grew and sent forth leaves."
"When?"
For the first time, Ferreira gazed directly at the priest, while around the sunken cheeks played the faint smile of one who pities a youngster with no knowledge of the world.
"When you first came to this country, churches were built everywhere. Faith was fragrant like the fresh flowers of the morning, and many Japanese vied with one another to receive baptism like the Jews who gathered at the Jordan."
"And supposing the God whom those Japanese believed in was not the God of Christian teaching?" Ferreira murmured these words slowly, the smile of pity still lingering on his lips. Feeling an incomprehensible anger rising up from the depth of his heart, the priest unconsciously clenched his fists.
"Be reasonable," he told himself desperately. "Don't be deceived by this sophistry. The defeated man uses any self-deception whatsoever to defend himself."
"You are denying the undeniable," he said aloud.
"Not at all. What the Japanese of that time believed in was not our God. It was their own gods. For a long time we failed to realize this and firmly believed that they had become Christians."
Ferreira sat down on the floor with a gesture of tiredness. The bottom of his kimono fell open, exposing dirty bare legs, thin like poles.
"I am saying this neither to defend myself nor to convince you. I suppose that no one will believe what I am saying. Not only you, but the missionaries in Goa and Macau and all the European priests will refuse to believe me. And yet, after 20 years of labour here, I knew the Japanese. I saw that little by little, almost imperceptibly, the roots of the sapling we had planted decayed.
Saint Francis Xavier, Rodriguez, unable to contain himself any longer, interrupted the other with a gesture.
Saint Francis Xavier, when he was in Japan, did not have that idea.
Even that saint, Ferreira nodded, failed to notice this.
But his very word, Deus, the Japanese freely changed into Dainichi, the great sun. To the Japanese who adored the sun, the pronunciation of Deus and Dainichi was almost the same. Have you not read the letter in which Xavier speaks of that mistake?
If Xavier had had a good interpreter, such a strange and trifling error would never have arisen.
By no means. You don't understand what I'm saying.
For the first time, nervous irritation appeared around his temples as Ferreira answered.
You understand nothing. And the crowd that comes for sightseeing to this country from the monasteries of Goa and Macau, calling themselves apostles, they understand nothing either. From the beginning, those same Japanese who confused Deus and Dainichi twisted and changed our God and began to create something different. Even when the confusion of vocabulary disappeared, the twisting and changing secretly continued. Even in the glorious missionary period, you mentioned the Japanese did not believe in the Christian God, but in their own distortion.
They twisted and changed our God and made something different. The priest slowly bit the words with his teeth.
Isn't even that our Deus? No. In the minds of the Japanese, the Christian God was completely changed. What are you saying?
At the priest's loud cry, the chicken that had been quietly nibbling food on the bare floor fluttered off into a corner.
What I say is simple. You and those like you are only looking at the externals of missionary work. You're not considering the kernel. It is true, as you say, that in my 20 years of labour in Kyoto, in Kyushu, in Chugoku, in Sendai, and the rest, churches were built. In Arima and Azuchi, seminaries were established. And the Japanese vied with one another to become Christians. You have just said that there were 200,000 Christians, but even that figure is conservative. There was a time when we had 400,000.
That is something to be proud of.
Proud? Yes, if the Japanese had come to believe in the God we taught. But in the churches we built throughout this country, the Japanese were not praying to the Christian God. They twisted God to their own way of thinking, in a way we can never imagine. If you call that God.
Ferreira lowered his eyes and moved his lips as though something had occurred to him.
No, that is not God. It is like a butterfly caught in a spider's web. At first, it is certainly a butterfly, but the next day only the externals, the wings and the trunk, are those of a butterfly. It has lost its true reality and has become a skeleton. In Japan, our God is just like that butterfly, caught in the spider's web. Only the exterior form of God remains, but it has already become a skeleton.
Nothing of the sort. I don't want to listen to your nonsensical talk. I have not been in Japan as long as you, but with these very eyes I have seen the martyrs. The priest covered his face with his hands and his voice penetrated through his fingers. With my own eyes, I have seen them die, burning with faith. The memory of the rain-drenched sea, with the two black stakes floating on its surface, arose painfully before his mind's eye. Nor could he forget the one-eyed man killed in plain daylight. While indelibly imprinted on his mind was the picture of the woman who had given him a cucumber. She had been thrust into a basket and drowned in the sea. If these people had not died for their faith, what a blasphemy to man. Ferreira is lying.
They did not believe in the Christian God.
Ferreira spoke clearly and with self-confidence, deliberately emphasizing every word.
The Japanese, till this day, have never had the concept of God, and they never will.
These words descended on the priest's heart like the weight of a huge, immovable rock,
and with something of that power that had been there when as a child he first heard about the existence of God.
The Japanese are not able to think of God completely divorced from man. The Japanese cannot think of an existence that transcends the human. Christianity and the Church are truths that transcend all countries and territories. If not, what meaning is there in our missionary work? The Japanese imagine a beautiful, exalted man, and this they call God. They call by the name of God something which has the same kind of existence as man, but that is not the Church's God.
Is that the only thing you have learnt from your 20 years in this country?
Only that. Ferreira nodded in a lonely way. And so the mission lost its meaning for me. The sapling I brought quickly decayed to its roots in this swamp. For a long time, I neither knew nor noticed this. At the last words of Ferreira, the priest was overcome with an uncontrollable sense of bitter resignation. The evening light began to lose its power. The shadows, little by little, stole over the floor. Far in the distance, the priest could hear the monotonous sound of the wooden drum and the voice of the bonzes chanting the sad sutras.
"You," the priest whispered, facing Ferreira, "you are not the Ferreira I knew."
"True, I am not Ferreira. I am a man who has received from the magistrate the name of Sawano Chuan," answered Ferreira, lowering his eyes. "And not only the name, I have received the wife and children of the executed man."
It is the hour of the boar. Once again in the palanquin, escorted by officials and guards, he is on the road. It is now dead of night. No need to worry about casual passers-by peering into the palanquin. The officials had given the priest permission to raise the blind. If he wanted, he could have escaped, but he no longer felt like doing so. The road was terribly narrow and twisted, and though the guards told him that they were already within the town, there were still clusters of farmhouses that looked like huts. But when they passed beyond them, they found here and there the long fences of temples and groves of trees. Nagasaki had not yet taken on the shape of a city. The moon rose up beyond the dark trees, and together with the palanquin seemed to move ever toward the west.
"You feel better now?" The official who rode along beside him spoke kindly.
Arriving at the prison, the priest uttered a word of gratitude to the guards and the officials, and then went inside. He heard the dull sound of the bolt being shot. It had been a long time since he had been here, and now at last he was back. It seemed such an age since he had heard the intermittent singing of the turtle dove in the grove. In comparison with his 10 days in prison, this one day had been long and painful. That he had at last met Ferreira was scarcely a reason for surprise, and the changed features and manner of the old man, now he came to think of it, this was something he had expected since coming to this country. The emaciated figure of Ferreira as he came tottering along that corridor from afar was not so terrifying. Now it did not matter. It did not matter. But to what extent was all he had said true? The priest sat staring at the blank wall while the rays of the moon pierced through the bars, bathing his back with light. Hadn't Ferreira talked in this way just to defend his own wrong and weakness? Yes, that was it. Of course it was so. One part of him kept insisting on this, but then quite suddenly a gust of fear would seize him, and he would wonder if what Ferreira said were not perhaps true. Ferreira had said that this Japan was a bottomless swamp. The sapling decayed at its roots and withered. Christianity was like this sapling. Quite unperceived, it had withered and died.
"It's not because of any prohibition, nor because of persecution that Christianity has perished. There's something in this country that completely stifles the growth of Christianity."
The words of Ferreira, uttered slowly, syllable by syllable, pierced the priest's ears.
"The Christianity they believe in is like the skeleton of a butterfly caught in a spider's web. It contains only the external form. The blood and the flesh are gone."
So Ferreira had gone on with blazing eyes, and somehow in his words there was a certain sincerity, unlike the self-deception of a defeated man. Now the footsteps of the guards could be heard in the distance. When they faded out, the only sound was the hoarse rasping of insects in the blackness of the night. It cannot be true. No, no, it is impossible. Rodriguez did not have enough missionary experience to refute Ferreira, but to accept the other's word was to lose everything for which he had come to this country. Banging his head against the wall, he kept murmuring monotonously, "It cannot be so. It is impossible." Yes, it is impossible. Impossible. How could anyone sacrifice himself for a false faith? With his own eyes, he had seen those peasants, poverty-stricken martyrs. If they had not had a true belief in salvation, how could they sink like stones in the mist-covered sea? On any account, they were strong Christians. Even if their belief was simple and crude, it breathed a conviction that had been implanted in Japan not by these officials, nor by Buddhism, but by the Christian Church. The priest recalled Ferreira's sadness. In the course of their conversation, Ferreira had said not one word about the poor Japanese martyrs. Of course, he had deliberately avoided this issue. He had tried to avoid any thought of people who were stronger than himself, people who had heroically endured torture and the pit. Ferreira was trying to increase, even by one, the number of weaklings like himself to share with others his cowardice and loneliness. In the darkness, he asked himself if now Ferreira was sleeping. No, he could not be asleep. The old man in some part of the same city was sitting in the darkness like himself, his eyes open, staring in front of him, biting at the depths of his solitude. And this loneliness was much colder, much more terrible than that which he endured in this prison cell. In order to pile weakness upon weakness, he was trying to drag others along the path that he himself had walked. Lord, will you not save him? Turning to Judas, you said, "What thou dost, do quickly." Will you number this man too among the abandoned sheep? And so, comparing his own loneliness and sadness with that of Ferreira, he felt for the first time some self-respect and satisfaction, and he was able quietly to laugh. Then, lying down on the hard, bare floor, he waited for the onrush of sleep. Chapter 8. The next day the interpreter visited him again.
"Well, have you thought it over?" he said.
This time he did not talk like a cat that plays with its prey. His expression was somehow stern.
"Sawano has told you. Give up this stubbornness. We're not telling you to trample in all sincerity. Won't you just go through with the formality of trampling? Just the formality. Then everything will be all right."
The priest remained silent, his eyes fixed on a point on the wall. It was not that the other's eloquence irritated him. It simply passed through his ears without conveying any meaning.
"Come now, don't cause more trouble. I'm asking you in all sincerity. It's not pleasant for me either."
"Why don't you hang me in the pit?"
"The magistrate keeps saying that it's better to make you see reason and accept our teaching."
Clasping his knees with his hands, the priest shook his head like a child. The interpreter heaved a deep sigh and for some time remained silent. A fly buzzed around with whirling wings.
"I see. Well, it can't be helped, then."
The dull sound of the bolt shot into place fell on the priest's ears, and with that dull sound he knew that all reasonable discussion had come to an end. To what extent he would be able to endure the torture, he could not tell. Yet somehow it no longer held for his exhausted body the terror it had aroused when he wandered through the mountains. He was numbed with pain now. He felt that it would be better for death to come as soon as possible if it was the only way to escape from this painful day-after-day suspense. Even life with anguish about God and about faith was a melancholy prospect. Secretly, he prayed in his heart that the fatigue of mind and body would quickly bring him death. Behind his eyelids, like a hallucination, floated the head of Garp, sinking down into the sea. How he envied his companion! Yes, how he envied Garp, free from anguish such as this. The next day, as he had expected, no breakfast was brought to him. Toward noon the door was opened, and a big fellow he had never yet seen, naked to the waist, showed his hollow face inside. He bound both of the priest's hands behind his back so tightly that when he moved his body even a little, the rope would bite into his wrists, and an involuntary cry of pain would escape from his clenched teeth. While binding his hands, the fellow kept muttering insults which the priest could not well understand. "At last the time has come," he thought within himself. But strange to say, this emotion was accompanied by a freshness and a sense of elation such as he had never before experienced. He was dragged outside. In the courtyard, bathed in sunlight, were three officials, four guards, and the interpreter, all standing in line and staring at him. The priest looked at them, especially at the interpreter, and a smile of triumph passed over his face. "No matter what the circumstances, no man can completely escape from vanity," he reflected, and then he joyfully recalled that until this moment he had not even noticed this fact. The big fellow grabbed the priest lightly in his arms and set him astride the bare back of a horse. Rather than a horse, it looked like a thin and starved donkey. It tottered forward, and behind it marched the officials, the guards, and the interpreter. Already the road was jammed with Japanese, waiting for the line to pass by, and from his position astride the horse, the priest smiled down at them. Old people, mouths agape with astonishment, children nibbling at cucumbers, women who would first laugh, stare at him like idiots, and then suddenly retreat in terror when their eyes met his. On each of these faces the light threw a different shadow. Then, behind his ear, came flying something like a brown clump. It was a piece of horse manure that someone had pitched at him. He made up his mind that he would not let the smile leave his lips. Here he was, riding through the streets of Nagasaki on a donkey. Another man had entered Jerusalem, likewise riding a donkey. And it was that man who had taught him that the most noble expression on the face of man is the glad acceptance of injury and insult. He would preserve such an expression until the end. This was the face of a Christian among the infidel. A group of Buddhist monks, openly displaying feelings of hostility toward him, gathered under the shade of a huge tree, and then, coming up and thronging around the donkey on which he was seated, brandished sticks as if to threaten and intimidate him. The priest looked at the faces that surrounded him, wondering if he might find some secret believer, but it was in vain. There was no face that was not stamped with hostility or hatred or curiosity. And there, in the midst of them, he caught sight of one who looked just like a dog that begs for pity. Unconsciously, the priest stiffened. It was Kichijiro. Clad in tatters, Kichijiro stood in the front rank, waiting. When his eyes met those of the priest, he cowered and quickly tried to conceal himself in the crowd. But the priest, from his position on the tottering donkey, knew just how far the fellow had followed after him. Amongst all these infidels, this was the only man he knew. "All right, all right, I am not angry now. Our Lord is not angry." The priest nodded toward Kichijiro, as if to give him the consolation given to the penitent after confession. According to the records, it is said that on this day the crowd escorted the priest from Hakata to Katsuyama and then passed on through Goto. When missionaries were captured, on the day before their punishment, it was customary for the magistrate to have them dragged around Nagasaki in this way as showpieces. The place through which the procession went was always the old marketplace of Nagasaki, where houses are close together and people throng in crowds. On the day after their being dragged around, it was customary for them to be brought to the place of execution. In the time of Amuro Sumitada, when the port of Nagasaki was first opened, Gotomachi was the territory where the immigrants from the Goto Islands lived, and from here the Bay of Nagasaki could be seen glittering in the afternoon sun. The crowds that came jostling after the procession pushed one another aside, just as they did at a festival, trying to get a view of the queer foreign barbarian bound astride a bare-backed horse. When the priest would try to straighten his tortured body, the cry of derision was raised with even greater glee. At first, he had tried to force a smile, but now his face had hardened, and it was no longer possible. The only thing he could do was to close his eyes and try not to see the faces that jibed at him, the faces with those protruding teeth. He wondered if that man had smiled gently when the multitude surrounded Pilate's mansion with shrieks and howls of anger. Even that man was incapable of such a thing, he reflected. Hoc passionis tempore. The words of the prayer fell from his lips like pebbles, and as he continued, they came only with great difficulty. He was distracted by the tormenting pain of the rope, which bit into his wrists whenever he moved his body. But what grieved him most was his inability to love these people as Christ had loved them.
"Well, Father, how is it? Does no one come to help you?"
It was the interpreter who, coming up beside him, quite suddenly shouted up,
"To your right and left, are there nothing but voices of derision? And to think that you came to this country for them, and yet not a single one feels that he needs you. You're a useless fellow. Useless!"
"And yet," for the first time the priest shouted in a loud voice, as from the horse's back he glared at the interpreter with bloodshot eyes,
"and yet in that crowd there may be some who are praying in the silence of their hearts. Now I'm going to tell you something, all right? Long ago, here in Nagasaki, there were 11 churches and 200,000 Christians. And where is it all now? Where are they hiding now? There are people in this crowd who were once Christians, but now they ridicule you with all their might and main to prove to those around that they are not Christians."
"Insult me as much as you like. You only give me more courage."
"Tonight,"
the interpreter laughed as he slapped the belly of the horse with the palm of his hand.
"All right. Tonight you will apostatize. Inoue said so very clearly. Until now, when Inoue has said that one of the fathers will apostatize, he has never been wrong. He was right in the case of Sawano. He will be right in your case, too."
The interpreter rubbed his hands in a gesture of supreme confidence and then withdrew from his position beside the priest.
"In the case of Sawano..."
It was these last words that remained in the priest's ears. From the bare back of the horse, he trembled and strove to drive the words from his mind. Beyond the bay, an enormous column of clouds glistened gold-edged in the afternoon light. For some reason he could not understand, these clouds looked like some gigantic castle in the sky in their great billowing whiteness. Many times before he had seen columns of white cloud, but never before had they stirred such emotion in his breast. He began to understand the beauty of the hymn of the Christians which he had heard when first he came to Japan. "We're on our way, we're on our way, we're on our way to the Temple of Paradise. Far away is the Temple of Paradise." His only solace and support was in the thought of that other man who had also tasted fear and trembling. And then there was joy in the thought that he was not alone. In this very sea, those two Japanese peasants bound to stakes had endured the same suffering for a whole day before passing on to the far Temple of Paradise. Suddenly, his breast was filled with a wild joy in the thought that he was united with these two Japanese, united with Garp, united with that man nailed to the cross. And that man's face pursued him like a living, vivid image, the suffering Christ, the patient Christ. From the depths of his heart, he prayed that his own face might draw near to that face. Raising their whips, the officials drove the crowd aside, and the people scattered like flies, meekly, without resistance, terror in their eyes, and making way for the procession, they watched it depart. At last, the afternoon was over. The evening sun fell glistening on the red roof of a temple at the left of the road. Just beyond the town, a mountain seemed to be floating in the sky. Now again, stones and pieces of manure came flying through the air, striking the priest on the cheek. Walking beside the horse, the interpreter kept up the same line of argument.
"Come now, I'm not urging you to something bad.
apostatize. Just say one word, please. If you do this, your horse will never bring you back to prison.
Where are you bringing me now?
To the magistrate's office. I don't want to make you suffer. Please. I'm not saying anything wrong. Just say the word, I apostatize.
Biting his lip, the priest sat silently on the horse. The blood from his cheek flowed down onto his chin. The interpreter looked at him, and with one hand on the belly of the horse kept on walking, a sad expression on his face. Bending down, the priest made his way into the room in the thick darkness. Suddenly he was halted by a foul stench. It was the smell of urine. The floor was completely covered with it, and for a moment he stood still, trying to keep himself from vomiting. After some time, through the darkness, he was at last able to distinguish the walls from the floor, and with his fingers against the wall, groping his way around the room, he suddenly hit against another wall. Stretching out his arms, he realized that the tips of his fingers could touch both walls at the same time. This gave him some idea of the size of the room he was in. He strained his ears, but could hear no voice. It was impossible to know what part of the magistrate's building he was in, but the deathly silence assured him that there was no one anywhere near. The walls were made of wood, and as he touched the upper part, his fingers discovered a large, deep crack. At first, he thought that this was one of the cracks between the boards, but somehow he also had the feeling that it could not be so. As he kept on feeling it with his hands, he gradually realized that it was the letter L. The next letter was A. Like a blind man, his fingers felt their way around the ensuing letters and found Laudate Eum. Beyond this, his fingers felt nothing more. Probably some missionary cast into this prison had cut out these words in Latin for the benefit of the next person who might be here. While in this place, this missionary had not apostatized. He had been burning with faith, and here, all alone in the dark, the priest was filled with emotion to the point of tears at the thought of what had happened. He felt that to the end he himself was being protected in some way. He did not know what time of night it was. In the long journey through the streets to the magistrate's office, the interpreter and the officials whom he did not know had kept repeating the same questions. Where had he come from? What society did he belong to? How many missionaries were in Macau? But they had not urged him to renounce his faith. Even the interpreter seemed to change his tune completely, for with expressionless face he had simply performed his duty of translating the words of the officials. When this absurd examination was finished, they had brought him back to his cell. Laudate Eum. Leaning his head against the wall, the priest followed his usual custom of thinking about that man whom he loved. Just as a young man might envisage the face of his intimate friend who is far away, the priest, from long ago, had the habit of imagining the face of Christ in his moments of solitude. And yet, since he had been captured, especially during the nights of imprisonment in that copse, when he had listened to the rustling of the leaves, a different sensation filled his breast when the face of that man rose behind his closed eyelids. Now, in the darkness, that face seemed close beside him. At first it was silent, but pierced him with a glance that was filled with sorrow. And then it seemed to speak to him. When you suffer, I suffer with you. To the end, I am close to you. While thinking of this face, the priest thought also of Garp. Soon he would be with Garp again. In his dreams at night, he had sometimes seen that black head chasing after the boat and sinking in the sea. And then he was intolerably ashamed to think about himself who had abandoned the Christians. So intolerable was the thought that sometimes he would try not to think about Garp at all. Far in the distance, he heard a voice. It was like that of a couple of dogs yelping and fighting. He strained his ears, but the sound had already ceased, and then for a long time it continued. Unconsciously, the priest laughed to himself in a low voice. He had realized that it was the sound of someone snoring. One of the guards was sound asleep, drunk with sake. For some time, the snoring continued intermittently. Now it was high, now low, like the sound of a badly played flute.
Here he was, in this dark cell, overwhelmed with the emotion of a man who faces death, while another man snored in this carefree way. The thought struck him as utterly ludicrous. "Why is human life so full of grotesque irony?" he muttered quietly to himself. The interpreter had confidently asserted that tonight he would apostatize. If only he knew my true feelings. As these thoughts crossed his mind, the priest withdrew his head from against the wall and laughed gently. Before his eyes there floated the untroubled face of that guard, snoring in his deep sleep. "If he's snoring like that, he doesn't fear that I'll try to escape," he reflected. Yet he no longer had the slightest intention of trying to escape. But just to give himself some distraction, he pushed the door with both hands. But the bolt was shot from outside, and he could not move it. Theoretically, he knew that death was near, but, strangely enough, emotion did not seem to keep pace with reason. Yes, death was drawing near. When the snoring ceased, the tremendous stillness of the night surrounded the priest. It was not that the stillness of the night was completely without sound. Just as the darkness floats over the trees, the awfulness of death suddenly descended upon him, filling him with terror. Wringing his hands, he yelled in a loud voice, and then the terror receded like the tide. But once again, like the tide, it came surging on. He tried earnestly to pray to our Lord, and intermittently there came into his mind the words, "His sweat became like drops of blood." As he saw the emaciated face of that man, there was no consolation in the thought that he too had tasted this same terror in the face of death. Wiping his brow with his hand, the priest got up and began to walk around his narrow cell to give himself some distraction. He could not stay still, he had to move. At last, far in the distance, he heard a voice. Even if this was the executioner come to put him to the torture, this was better than the cold darkness that was cutting him more deeply than any sword. The priest put his ear to the door to get something of what the voice was saying. Someone seemed to be upbraiding someone else. There was a voice of derision mingled with a voice of entreaty. The wrangling would stop far away, then again it seemed to come near to where he was. As the priest listened to the voices, his thoughts suddenly turned in a completely different direction. "The reason why darkness is terrifying for us," he reflected, "is that there remains in us the instinctive fear the primitive man had when there was as yet no light." Such was the crazy thought that came into his mind. "Didn't I tell you to go away immediately?" a man was scolding someone. Then the fellow who had been scolded would cry out in a tearful voice, "I'm a Christian," he was shouting. "Let me meet the Father." The voice was somehow familiar. Yes, it was the voice of Kichijiro. "Let me meet the Father, let me meet the Father." "Keep quiet. If you keep shouting like that, I'll thrash you." "Thrash me, thrash me." The voice was mingled all the time with that of another. "Who is he?" said yet another voice. "He seems to be crazy. He's like a beggar. But since yesterday, he keeps saying that he's a Christian." Then suddenly, the voice of Kichijiro echoed out loudly, "Father, forgive me. I've come to make my confession and receive absolution. Forgive me."
"What are you talking about?"
Then there was a sound like that of a falling tree as Kichijiro was struck by the jailer.
"Father, forgive me."
The priest closed his eyes and silently uttered the words of absolution. A bitter taste lay on his tongue.
"I was born weak. One who is weak at heart cannot die a martyr. What am I to do? Oh, why was I born into the world at all?"
The voice broke off like the fading of the breeze, and then it could be heard far in the distance. Suddenly, before the priest's eyes, there floated the vision of Kichijiro as he had been when he returned to Goto, the popular man among his fellow Christians. If there had been no persecution, this fellow would undoubtedly have lived out his life as a happy, good-humoured Christian man.
"Why was I born into the world? Why? Why?"
The priest thrust his fingers into his ears to shut out that voice that was like the whining of a dog. Yes, he had whispered the words of absolution for Kichijiro, but this prayer had not come from the depths of his heart.
He had simply recited the words out of a sense of priestly duty. That was why they still lay heavy on his tongue, like the residue of some bitter food. His resentment against Kichijiro, it was true, had now vanished. But yet deep down in his memory was still engraved the memory of his betrayal, the smell of the dried fish that this fellow had made him eat, the burning thirst that had followed. Even though he no longer entertained emotions of hatred and anger, he could not erase from his memory the feeling of contempt. Again, he bit at those words of warning that Christ had addressed to Judas. These were words that, from of old, he had never understood when he read the Bible. And not only these words, but the whole role of Judas in that man's life was something he had never been able to grasp. Why had that man included among his disciples the man who would eventually betray him? Even though he knew the real intention of Judas, why had he made as if he knew nothing for such a long time? Wasn't Judas no more than a puppet made use of for that man's crucifixion? And yet, if that man was love itself, why had he rejected Judas in the end? Judas had hanged himself at the field of blood. Had he been cast aside to sink down into eternal darkness? Even as a seminarian and a priest, such doubts had arisen in his mind like dirty bubbles that rise to the surface of water in a swamp. And in such moments, he tried to think of these bubbles as things that soiled the purity of his faith. But now they came upon him with a persistence that was irresistible. Shaking his head, he heaved a sigh. The last judgment would come. It was not given to man to understand all the mysteries of the Scriptures. Yet he wanted to know. He wanted to find out. "Tonight you will certainly apostatize," the interpreter had said confidently. How like the words that man had addressed to Peter. "Tonight, before the cock crows, you will deny me thrice." The dawn was still far away. It was not time for the cock to crow. Ah, that snoring again. It was like the sound of a windmill turned around in the breeze. The priest sat down on the floor, soaked with urine, and like an idiot, he laughed. What a queer thing man was. Here was the stupid groaning snore, now high, now low, of some ignorant fellow who felt no fear of death. There, fast asleep like a pig, opening his big mouth, he could snore just like that. He felt that he could see the guard's face with his own eyes. It was a fat face, heavy with sake and bloated, health itself. But for the victims, the face was terribly cruel. Moreover, this guard did not possess any aristocratic cruelty. Rather was it the cruelty of a low-class fellow toward beasts and animals weaker than himself. He had seen such fellows in the countryside in Portugal, and he knew them well. This fellow had not the slightest idea of the suffering that would be inflicted on others because of his conduct. It was this kind of fellow who had killed that man whose face was the best and the most beautiful that ever one could dream of. Yes, and that on this, the most important night of his whole life, he should be disturbed by such a vile and discordant noise, this realization suddenly filled him with rage. He felt that his life was simply being trifled with. And when the groaning ceased for a moment, he began to beat on the wall. But the guards, like those disciples who in Gethsemane slept in utter indifference to the torment of that man, did not get up. Again he began to beat wildly on the wall. Then there came the noise of the door being opened, and from the distance the sound of feet hastening rapidly toward the place where he was.
"Father, what is wrong? What is wrong?"
It was the interpreter who spoke, and his voice was that of the cat playing with its prey.
"It's terrible, terrible. Isn't it better for you not to be so stubborn? If you simply say, 'I apostatize,' all will be well. Then you will be able to let your strained mind relax and be at ease."
"It's only that snoring," answered the priest through the darkness. Suddenly, the interpreter became silent, as if in astonishment.
"You think that is snoring? That is..." "Sawano, did you hear what he said? He thought that sound was snoring."
The priest had not known that Ferreira was standing beside the interpreter.
"Sawano, tell him what it is."
The priest heard the voice of Ferreira.
That voice he had heard every day long ago, it was low and pitiful.
That's not snoring. That is the moaning of Christians hanging in the pit.
Ferreira stood there motionless, his head hanging down like an old animal. The interpreter, true to type, put his head down to the barely open door and for a long time peered in at the scene. Waiting and waiting, he heard no sound, and uneasily whispered in a hoarse voice,
"I suppose you're not dead?" "Oh, no, no. It's not lawful for a Christian to put an end to that life given him by God. So, Arno, the rest is up to you."
With these words, he turned around and disappeared from sight, his footsteps echoing in the darkness. When the footsteps had completely died out, Ferreira, silent, his head hanging down, made no movement. His body seemed to be floating in air like a ghost. It looked thin, like a piece of paper, small like that of a child. One would think that it was impossible even to clasp his hand.
"Hey," he said, putting his face in at the door. "Hey, can you hear me?"
There was no answer, and Ferreira repeated the same words.
"Somewhere on that wall," he went on, "you should be able to find the lettering that I engraved there. Laudate Eum. Unless they have been cut away. The letters are on the right-hand wall. Yes, in the middle. Won't you touch them with your fingers?"
But from inside the cell there came not the faintest sound. Only the pitch darkness where the priest lay huddled up in the cell and through which it seemed impossible to penetrate.
"I was here just like you."
Ferreira uttered the words distinctly, separating the syllables one from another.
"I was imprisoned here, and that night was darker and colder than any night in my life."
The priest leaned his head heavily against the wooden wall and listened vaguely to the old man's words. Even without the old man's saying so, he knew that that night had been blacker than any before. Indeed, he knew it only too well. The problem was not this. The problem was that he must not be defeated by Ferreira's temptings. The tempting of a Ferreira who had been shut up in the darkness just like himself and was now enticing him to follow the same path.
"I, too, heard those voices. I heard the groaning of men hanging in the pit."
And even as Ferreira finished speaking, the voices, like snoring, now high, now low, were carried to their ears. But now the priest was aware of the truth. It was not snoring. It was the gasping and groaning of helpless men hanging in the pit. While he had been squatting here in the darkness, someone had been groaning as the blood dripped from his nose and mouth. He had not even adverted to this. He had uttered no prayer. He had laughed. The very thought bewildered him completely. He had thought the sound of that voice ludicrous, and he had laughed aloud. He had believed in his pride that he alone in this night was sharing in the suffering of that man. But here, just beside him, were people who were sharing in that suffering much more than he.
"Why this craziness?" murmured a voice that was not his own. "And you call yourself a priest? A priest who takes upon himself the suffering of others? Lord, until this moment, have you been mocking me?" he cried aloud. "Laudate Eum. I engraved those letters on the wall," Ferreira repeated. "Can't you find them? Look again."
"I know," the priest, carried away by anger, shouted louder than ever before. "Keep quiet," he said. "You have no right to speak like this."
"I have no right? That is certain. I have no right. Listening to those groans all night, I was no longer able to give praise to the Lord. I did not apostatize because I was suspended in the pit. For 3 days, I, who stand before you, was hung in a pit of foul excrement, but I did not say a single word that might betray my God."
Ferreira raised a voice that was like a growl as he shouted,
"The reason I apostatized. Are you ready? Listen. I was put in here and heard the voices of those people for whom God did nothing. God did not do a single thing. I prayed with all my strength, but God did nothing."
"Be quiet."
"All right, pray. but those Christians are partaking of a terrible suffering such as you cannot even understand. From yesterday, in the future, now at this very moment, why must they suffer like this? And while this goes on, you do nothing for them, and God, he does nothing either. The priest shook his head wildly, putting both fingers into his ears. But the voice of Ferreira, together with the groaning of the Christians, broke mercilessly in. Stop! Stop! Lord, it is now that you should break the silence. You must not remain silent. Prove that you are justice, that you are goodness, that you are love. You must say something to show the world that you are the August One. A great shadow passed over his soul, like that of the wings of a bird flying over the mast of a ship. The wings of the bird now brought to his mind the memory of the various ways in which the Christians had died. At that time, too, God had been silent. When the misty rain floated over the sea, he was silent. When the one-eyed man had been killed beneath the blazing rays of the sun, he had said nothing. But at that time, the priest had been able to stand it, or rather than stand it, he had been able to thrust the terrible doubt far from the threshold of his mind. But now it was different. Why is God continually silent while those groaning voices go on? Now they are in that courtyard. It was the sorrowful voice of Ferreira that whispered to him. Three unfortunate Christians are hanging. The old man was telling no lie. As he strained his ears, the groaning that had seemed to be that of a single voice suddenly revealed itself as a double one. One groaning was high. It never became low. The high voice and the low voice were mingled with one another, coming from different persons. When I spent that night here, five people were suspended in the pit. Five voices were carried to my ears on the wind. The official said, if you apostatize, those people will immediately be taken out of the pit, their bonds will be loosed, and we will put medicine on their wounds. I answered, why do these people not apostatize? And the official laughed as he answered me, they have already apostatized many times, but as long as you don't apostatize, these peasants cannot be saved. And you, the priest spoke through his tears, you should have prayed. I did pray. I kept on praying, but prayer did nothing to alleviate their suffering. Behind their ears, a small incision has been made. The blood drips slowly through this incision and through the nose and mouth. I know it well, because I have experienced that same suffering in my own body. Prayer does nothing to alleviate suffering. The priest remembered how at Saishoji, when he first met Ferreira, he had noticed a scar like a burn on his temples. He even remembered the brown colour of the wound. And now the whole scene rose up behind his eyelids. To chase away the imagination, he kept banging his head against the wall. In return for these earthly sufferings, those people will receive a reward of eternal joy, he said. Don't deceive yourself, said Ferreira. Don't disguise your own weakness with those beautiful words. My weakness! The priest shook his head, yet he had no self-confidence. What do you mean? It's because I believe in the salvation of these people. You make yourself more important than them. You are preoccupied with your own salvation. If you say that you will apostatize, those people will be taken out of the pit. They will be saved from suffering, and you refuse to do so. It's because you dread to betray the church. You dread to be the dregs of the church, like me. Until now, Ferreira's words had burst out as a single breath of anger, but now his voice gradually weakened as he said, Yet I was the same as you. On that cold black night, I too was as you are now. And yet is your way of acting love? A priest ought to live in imitation of Christ. If Christ were here... For a moment, Ferreira remained silent. Then he suddenly broke out in a strong voice, Certainly Christ would have apostatized for them. Night gradually gave place to dawn. The cell that until now had been no more than a lump of black darkness began to glimmer in a tiny flicker of whitish light. Christ would certainly have apostatized to help men.
No, no, said the priest, covering his face with his hands and wrenching his voice through his fingers. No, no.
For love, Christ would have apostatized, even if it meant giving up everything he had.
Stop tormenting me! Go away, away! Shouted the priest wildly. But now the bolt was shot and the door opened, and the white light of the morning flooded into the room.
You are now going to perform the most painful act of love that has ever been performed, said Ferreira, taking the priest gently by the shoulder.
Swaying as he walked, the priest dragged his feet along the corridor. Step by step, he made his way forward, as if his legs were bound by heavy leaden chains, and Ferreira guided him along. In the gentle light of the morning, the corridor seemed endless, but there at the end stood the interpreter and two guards, looking just like three black dolls.
Soano, is it over? Shall we get out the fumi?
As he spoke, the interpreter put on the ground the box he was carrying, and opening it, he took out a large wooden plaque.
Now you are going to perform the most painful act of love that has ever been performed, Ferreira repeated his former words gently. Your brethren in the church will judge you as they have judged me, but there is something more important than the church, more important than missionary work, what you are now about to do.
The fumi is now at his feet. A simple copper medal is fixed onto a grey plank of dirty wood, on which the grains run like little waves. Before him is the ugly face of Christ, crowned with thorns, and the thin, outstretched arms. Eyes dimmed and confused, the priest silently looks down at the face which he now meets for the first time since coming to this country.
Ah, says Ferreira, courage.
Lord, since long, long ago, innumerable times, I have thought of your face. Especially since coming to this country have I done so tens of times. When I was in hiding in the mountains of Tomogi, when I crossed over in the little ship, when I wandered in the mountains, when I lay in prison at night, whenever I prayed, your face appeared before me. When I was alone, I thought of your face imparting a blessing. When I was captured, your face, as it appeared when you carried your cross, gave me life.